This is The End User, episode 137 for Tuesday, June 11th. Swipe Fence to Unlock. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Chris, it's a great day to be a futurist, but it's not a really great day to be an Apple fanboy or an Xbox gamer.
Why is it not a really good day?
Well, see, Apple had their Worldwide Developers Conference keynote today, and they announced all this great new awesome stuff. Microsoft finally gave us all the details on their new Xbox One, but the thing is, we're not going to see any of them for 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, not till the holiday season, I guess, right?
Right. So for the next, you know, season and a half or so, we just have to sit and twiddle our thumbs and wait and hate the things that we have now.
Well, I don't know. That's pretty dramatic. I like a lot of what I've seen, but that's a little hyperbolic, don't you think?
Well, I don't know. You weren't paying as close attention to the Apple keynote as I was. There's some pretty great brand spanking new stuff in there. So I guess we should start telling everybody what they are.
Yeah, let's get into it. We're live in the middle of a thunderstorm, and hopefully Skype doesn't give out on us, but let's get into it.
All right, so after going through the regular rigmarole, talking about all the new business they've drummed up, how much everyone loves Apple, their new store in Berlin in a 100-year-old building, they started getting to the real meat, and they started by talking about the new MacBook Airs. Now, this is probably the smallest refresh that we saw today, but they started by saying, hey, we've got this great new technology. It's going to make the computers so much faster that we can actually drop the clock speeds and save even more battery life. So now the 11-inch MacBook Air gets 9 hours of battery life standard, and the 13-inch gets 12 hours of battery standard. And in addition to that, they have added 802.11ac Wi-Fi networking, so that's faster than gigabit Ethernet.
Well, no, isn't it on par with gigabit?
Well, it technically has higher top speeds.
Oh, interesting. But you probably just won't see it in real life. But yeah, that's
if you're in the same room, you probably will. And it's supposedly it has better wall penetration ability than 802.11n, which was a big problem at 5 gigahertz.
Yeah, I also have heard that as well. We're going to start to see this be a standard in every single laptop that's coming out. And Apple is kind of leading the charge. I haven't seen too many devices that are actually have this now. Even through Computex, there are a lot of devices that didn't mention it or didn't have it in the first place. So,
right. And so to power the fast internet and Wi-Fi on these computers, they went ahead and updated their airport routers. So they updated the entire line. The Airport Express, the little hockey puck size one, looks the same. The new Airport Extreme and the Time Capsule are now much, much smaller. They're the same footprint as the Airport Express, but about 6 or 7 inches tall for some reason.
That's interesting. So did they roll out AC into the new airports, or is that still forthcoming?
Yes, all of their new airports are 802.11ac.
Yeah, that's awesome, because there aren't very many routers out there that can do AC. So having this be one of them is great.
Yeah, that's right. And they're very strange looking, but they are very proud of the technology that they put in them. Apparently, they made them 7 inches tall so that they could put all 6 antennas right at the top of the device to have greater broadcasting range. Furthermore, they have built-in beamforming technology to locate the direction of each computer on the network and send stronger signals towards the computers themselves.
Cool. So I'm looking at a couple routers right now. They're about $180. Did we get a price on the Airport AC version?
I'm assuming they're going to be the same price. So it's $99 for the Airport Express,
right.
$180 for the Airport Extreme. And I think last I checked, it was still $300 for the Time Capsule with its built-in 2 terabyte hard drive.
Yeah, I was going to say, 2 gigabytes wouldn't buy you very much backup now, would it?
No. two or three terabytes.
Yeah, so that's always been, if you are a Mac household, that's easily the best way to back up your Mac computers.
Yeah, another thing they added to these devices is the ability to instantly set it up right out of the box from your Mac or iOS device. So without even going into any utilities, the built-in standard Wi-Fi functions of either your Mac or your iPhone or your iPad will automatically set up the router for you. So it's basically one click.
Yeah, and setting up a router is always kind of a pain. Most people don't understand what is going on with their router. I feel like the people that listen to this podcast obviously understand what's going on with their router, but I can't tell you how many times I've gotten called in to give tech support just because somebody needed to reset their router or something like that.
Yeah, now that's true. So as far as new Apple hardware, that is just about it. I was hoping maybe we might see new MacBook Pros or new Mac Minis. Usually they do the Mac Minis or the MacBook Pros along with the MacBook Air. But what I did not expect was a brand new Mac Pro. This is the first time they've updated since the last WWDC. And it had been 2 years before that. And now they've completely changed the game in terms of powerful Mac desktops. This is a brand new form factor. It's much smaller than the existing Mac Pro, and it's just been re-engineered top to bottom. It's a work of engineering magnificence.
So this thing can also make coffee, as it seems. Definitely a good espresso brew coming out of this computer. Yeah, this is very, very interesting to me, and it signals a larger change, because I think even nowadays, if you go and buy a powerful desktop computer, you're going to get something that is rectangular, that sits on a desk or on the floor as it is, and you know, has expansion slots and stuff like that. And that's what you get when you go to buy that kind of computer. And this is definitely not that.
It is not at all. It's much smaller. They have designed a custom chassis that is able to pull heat quickly and quietly from the insane amount of hardware that they've packed into it. The whole face of it is glossy black aluminum, and the entire body, which is cylindrical, rotates freely. So you can spin it around to the back to get access to the ports, or spin the ports back to the back of the computer to hide the cables and such.
Yeah, so I think this kind of device, and you have to go see the pictures if you want to know exactly what we're talking about, but yeah, it looks somewhere between a coffee maker and a vacuum or something. A Dyson vacuum, mind you. A well-designed vacuum.
You're right, but much more minimal.
I think this kind of... I don't know if this will set a trend or not, but I think this is kind of an important point, is that we've gotten to a point with computers where we can push them out of the way now. They can basically be a flower vase that sits off to the side, that we don't need all of this crazy hardware that's, you know, really obvious and large and sits underneath the desk and that kind of thing. I think this is what they're trying to signal. Now, if it takes off as a trend, I don't know, because this is the device that really powerful users are going to go after. This is the device for audio engineers, and this is the device for video editing engineers, and it'll be interesting to see what their reaction is to this thing, because I gotta wonder, you know, are they going to say, well, really, that wimpy thing can do the work that I need to do? You know, I wonder if there's going to be some kind of mental block, but it is beautiful, if nothing else.
You only need to take one quick look at the specs to know that this can do the kind of work that any computer can do. And in fact, it can do the kind of work that many supercomputers can do. It is running the latest generation 12-core Xeon processor. They're putting the fastest RAM in it of any currently off-the-shelf computer. Its flash storage is 7 times faster than my solid-state drive in my computer, which itself was already 10 times faster than a hard drive.
Yeah, not than your spinny disk, than your flash disk.
Yes, it is many orders of magnitude faster than a disk-based hard drive.
Yeah, I think that this device was the this was the sneak of the show. I really wasn't expecting anything quite like this. And it's weird because people were speculating, oh, you know, their desktops are dead. They're not even going to bother with a new Mac Pro. And here they unveil this insane-looking thing with really good specs. And I'm excited about this. This looks cool. It's going to be too expensive for normal humans to buy, but that's another story, I guess.
Remember last week when we talked about that brand new 4K 31-inch display that came out, and we said basically no off-the-shelf computers could even power the whole display?
Well, here you go.
This can power three of them.
That's pretty wild. And that's due to the Thunderbolt 2 with its improved throughput, right?
Yeah, that's right. So they have two Thunderbolt 2 ports.
Nice.
Running on two separate graphics cards. And this thing, even though it's much smaller and it's like no form factor that's ever been released, it is expandable and upgradable. It has PCI Express built in and plenty of ports. In fact, the slowest port on the entire computer is the gigabit Ethernet.
That's pretty good. And it's really cool how they've put this thing together. I mean, it's basically in the middle, there's a chunk of heatsink that everything is surrounding on all sides. And then on the top, there's a fan that extracts heat from the heatsink and blows it upwards. It's really kind of neat the way they've put this thing together. I think you're right. It's nothing like I've ever seen. I'm sure some obscure person is finding some obscure design from some Japanese computer or something like that. But this is unlike anything I've seen.
I suppose you could compare it to a Cray supercomputer or maybe the old Apple G4 Cube, but those are the only comparisons that I can think of.
Yeah, so we don't have a word on pricing, right?
We don't, and we're not even sure when it's going to come out. They said it comes out in the fall. I'm sure it will be released near the same time as the brand new version of OS X, 10.9 Mavericks. They devoted a couple of minutes to explain that they just ran out of cat names, so they've come up with a new naming scheme. Mavericks is a famous surfing competition in Northern California, and that's the trend of their new operating system naming scheme. They're just going with California.
So no more big cats? That's kind of disappointing.
Yeah, they joked about using sea lion, and I think a lot of people would have been more excited about that, but... I guess it just didn't fit this scheme.
Yeah, I would have liked Sea Lion. That would have been kind of clever.
I would have liked Bobcat, but that's only because it was my college mascot.
But there are plenty of other large cats that you could throw onto.
Yes, but just not better ones.
I guess it ends at the King of the Jungle.
Well, they already went past the King of the Jungle.
But that really should have been the end.
Yeah, perhaps. But, they probably shouldn't have done Tiger and Leopard so soon.
Yeah, maybe. They jumped the shark. They should have just called it the Shark. Now that I think about it, I think that...
Perhaps.
Yeah, OS X Shark. All right, well, what's coming? What can we look forward to in Mavericks? What's going on here?
Okay, so the main improvements to Mavericks were just basically updating the operating system, making it fit the new hardware and the new design scheme, and fitting everything together so that it works much more seamlessly. They redesigned Mail so that it can send links to Safari or connect with the new Apple Maps, which they've brought in from iOS. They added iBooks from iOS as well. And under the hood, there are a lot of major improvements focused on efficiency. So there are a number of energy-saving schemes that will allow the processor to work much more efficiently and much less frequently.
Here's the tagline, Taylor. 72% less CPU activity.
Yeah, so the way that they do that is by bundling a bunch of CPU activities and waiting until they need to be made, and then running the CPU at peak efficiency all at once so that it can drop back down into a lower power state.
Interesting. So I've got to think that this is something that all of the other operating systems are already doing. Is this new and unique? I'm not sure. I guess I don't. I just don't know.
I don't think that they're doing anything on this level. I think we did see similar technology to what I just described when Windows 8 was released. But there are a lot of other things that it allows it to minimize energy and maximize performance, like cutting the CPU processes to screens or to windows that have been brought off screen. If you're watching some graphics intensive game or video or something, and then you switch to another window, it will automatically cut that down and divert resources elsewhere. They're also creating a process that will archive and compress files in the RAM that aren't being actively used in order to get more life out of how much memory you have in your computer. Another thing that they've done is finally bring full multiple screen support to the OS. Previously, you could use multiple screens, but you couldn't do anything in full screen if you had a second screen. If you put one window in full screen, the second screen would go blank automatically. Now each monitor, each display is a fully independent screen with its own dock, its own menu bar, and you can even do that in AirPlay. So you can send a screen to a TV and have it work completely independently of the other screens on the computer. They even have their own mission control where you can control multiple spaces on multiple screens and then move the spaces between the screens.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a good feature to have. I always, on Windows, there's a third-party utility you can use to get multiple desktops, but it's always something I've liked from the Linux world, and Mac also has it, having the notion of multiple virtual desktops. That's always something that I've thought was really useful and that Windows doesn't have. Here, so let me ask you this. Do we know the state of the scaling, like the scaling of the font and the like? So, for example, if you do have a 4K display, that text is going to be mighty small.
Well, I'm sure that Apple has learned a couple of things from releasing their Retina display MacBook Pros. For those two computers, they have custom scaling schemes.
Right.
So I bet that they have already worked out what they're going to do with 4K displays. And even 1080p displays, they have certain high-resolution modes that you can implement so that the text is not too small.
Yeah, that's good, because that's something we're going to need going forward, because there's no doubt that people want to move to 4K, right? The latest and greatest is always better, of course.
Yeah, and their solution is fairly elegant, but I would like to see it become more customizable, kind of like in the way that Windows 8 has set it up,
yeah.
That you can set different text sizes for the whole system based on the density of your screen.
And that was Windows Vista, my friend.
Well, I didn't like how it was implemented in Vista. I guess it matured in Windows 7.
Yeah.
And so I should call it a Windows 7 feature, not a Windows 8 feature.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Yeah, I can get on with that.
So that wasn't the only new operating system they announced. The much bigger deal to many people was the introduction of iOS 7, which has essentially been completely redesigned from the ground up by a design team headed by Joni Ive, who previously was only focused on hardware development and design.
Right, and I feel like he's brought a lot of very interesting things to iOS 7. It looks pretty good to me. So what do we got? This is a huge change. This is not really changing a lot of the functionality of how apps work and stuff like that, but it is changing the way the operating system works a little bit, and it is changing the way it feels a lot. We've got a lot of glass going on, which I find kind of interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of frosted glass overtones. Everything slides and blows up and shrinks. And they redesigned the font. They redesigned all the color schemes. All the notifications at the top of the screen look very much different. All the system fonts have become much more flat. But at the same time, there are a lot of layers and levels to this scheme. And they are really embracing the 3D look by using the accelerometer in the phone to move the background in a 3D effect whenever you turn the phone.
Parallax effect is the word.
Yeah.
So that's a really like whiz bang feature that I think it's great for a demo, but I'm not sure if it will hold up in real life. I'm sure some people will like it, but most will probably find it annoying, I'd imagine.
I thought it looked pretty cool myself. And
yeah, it does look cool.
I can't wait to try out some of this stuff. So they redesigned the lock screen so that now you no longer swipe across a little bar, but you simply swipe up from the bottom of the screen. And you can also now access the full notification center.
That sounds very familiar, Taylor.
It does, yes. But yeah, you have to have a swipe to unlock in some sort of capacity. And who was it that invented swipe to unlock?
Well, I think Apple was the first one that I saw do it in a phone.
Right.
But I believe Fences invented that. There's some prior art there. No, but I just mean swiping up from the bottom
the
is patent how...
Patent goes to Fences.
Patent goes to Fences win. But that's how Windows Phone 8 works, is you swipe up from the bottom and the lock screen floats away from you. So
right.
I'm not saying...
And I've seen versions of Android that work that way, too.
There are many versions of Android. Also, I know Fedora Linux happens to use that for their desktop operating system. So
I see.
I think that's a popular paradigm now. I think it's official.
Right. Now, another thing that they've stolen from another operating system. Actually, there are many comparisons that can be made between this new look of iOS 7 and Windows Phone 8, or just generally the modern UI from Windows 8 and Windows Phone. But they've definitely gone their own direction with it.
I think this represents not a Windows Phone or Windows 8 UI. I think this represents a UI of 2013. Because, Gmail kind of looks like this now. A lot of the Google properties are being redesigned to fit this kind of modern design language. Microsoft is also doing it. And everybody's kind of involved in throwing in some ideas. You know, Microsoft clearly has some ideas with the flatness that they've got. Apple's got a little tweak on it here with their frosted glass with kind of a little bit of depth, but not an insane amount of depth. And Android, it kind of looks like this now, too. So I think this is just the design of 2013, right?
It seems to be. Everybody's sort of moving in that direction. So they've added a few more things to the basic interface. In addition to the notification center, which now has three tabs, you can look at just your missed notifications, your notification summary for the day, or all notifications. There's now a command center where you swipe up from the bottom from the home screen where you can access things like airplane mode, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, rotation lock, brightness, music, AirPlay, the flashlight app, the camera, the calculator. It's a full featured command center.
Yeah, this is a great idea. I think that having stuff that you use a lot at your fingertips just plain old makes a lot of sense.
Especially the flashlight. I think that's an excellent addition to the built-in apps.
And the camera's down there too, if you need it.
Yeah, that's right. Now they've also redesigned the multitasking center. It's a full screen implementation now, where you get previews of each app that you have open. And furthermore, they've made the phone much more aware of background system processes, and the phone actually learns your behavior and will, at opportune moments, fetch notifications and preload app screens that it knows you're going to use at certain times of day.
Cool. So it says it's 8:15. I think Chris wants Twitter now.
Yeah. When Chris wakes up, he checks his Twitter. He checks his email. I'll have all those ready to go.
Yeah. That's cool. That makes a lot of sense. And I wonder if this is related to the work they were doing in OS X for some of the operating system level stuff that the queuing of all of the network activity. I wonder if they had some interplay between the iOS team and the OS X team there.
It may have been. The rumor was that they had pulled a lot of developers off of the OS X team and brought them on to the iOS 7 team, and maybe some of those ideas that they were working on were carried over. Now, they've also redesigned just about all of their built-in apps. The new Photos app seems really great. Much like you can organize events automatically in iPhoto for the Mac, what the iPhone now does in Photos will first organize all your whole collection of photos into years, and then it will look at the metadata and break it up into collections, which are based around location and time, and then within that, it subdivides it into smaller locations in time called moments, and everything is completely scalable. And even from the year view, you can quickly find an individual photo. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that looked really neat. It does remind me a little bit. Remember, we talked about the Google Auto Awesome features that they had with their Google Plus photo integration. It reminds me a little bit of that. So definitely good to see them get in on this. And it's funny because I feel like Google does this kind of stuff really well on the web, and Apple can't figure out the web, but they do it really well on the phone.
Yeah, that's right. Well, speaking of the web, they've redesigned Safari so that it has much more useful full-screen browsing mode. And they have added a new tab interface that allows you to have much more than 8 tabs, which is a welcome addition. And they've finally, I've been waiting for them to do this for a very long time, combined the search bars so that you don't have to click separately on an address bar or a Google search bar. Oh. And then as you type, it automatically integrates Google search results.
Right. That's
although Siri is now powered by Bing search.
Yeah, and isn't that a weird reversal? It's the Apple breakup with Google. We're seeing it materialize in front of our very eyes.
I wonder if it sort of has to do with the API access that Siri has between Bing or Google, but it's a very strange dichotomy that they've implemented all in one day. Siri also got a number of other features, a brand new voice that you can switch from male to female if you want to, and it sounds much more natural in the demonstrations that I heard. So it sounds more like a person.
Yeah, they said more realistic, although I've got to imagine that at some point in time you've got to be a little careful that they're not sounding too real. Like if I'm imagining a situation where you have something like Google Now happening, and it just starts talking to you in your ear, and you like turn around and say, "Where did that come from?" But I don't know. I think I'm crazy.
If Siri just starts talking to Google Now and you get cut out completely,
yeah, I'm going to get cut out. Where am I going to be?
You're the third wheel among your devices.
That's right. They're just going to start blinking at each other. So the bigger thing to me is the system commands that Siri is going to get. So you can do perform a bunch of actions on the phone as opposed to just kind of talking to it and having it look up information. I think that is kind of interesting. Although I'm not sure I would ever use it. It's one of these things that's kind of whiz bang and may be useful for people in their cars perhaps, but for me, I don't think that is terribly useful. So I acknowledge that there is a person out there that can use this, and I think that's a pretty good upgrade for that person.
Well, they've also added a whole new section called iOS in the car. It's all invisible within the operating system, but the idea is that when you plug it into compatible cars, the phone essentially disappears into the background. You're not supposed to look at it at all. They've added all these new things that Siri can, either on her own or through the car, can check your voicemails, read back messages, or get more directions and do turn-by-turn directions without accessing the screen.
This is the kind of feature that will either be a miserable flop or will be fantastically successful. You know, is this the iPod dock at the gym or is this the hi-fi speakers? It's really hard to say. It looks pretty good from what I've seen in the keynote. So I'll be looking forward to see how people react to it, because I think it's a really good idea to separate the car from the technology that drives the car. And I don't mean actually drives it down the street like the Google car, but I mean the GPS unit in the car should either be your smartphone or should be some kind of hot swappable unit, because technology moves too quickly for cars. They just cannot keep up with the consumer electronics inside the dash, right?
Yeah, over the last few years, I've noticed that a lot of cars have begun to allow their smartphone connection systems to become much more modular. So when you first had people connecting iPods to the cars, they had this idea that you would just plug your iPod into a dock connector and throw it in the glove box and then control everything from the center console. You can't do that now on any, you know, you can't connect a dock connector to any current iPod that Apple sells. So that doesn't work. So they started offering either proprietary connectors that you could buy, that you could upgrade the connection to whichever type of device you're using, and offer more system agnostic connector options, or sometimes even just USB things. But you have to be able to update the software in the car or figure out how to circumvent it.
All right, so it'll be kind of interesting to see if this takes off or not, because, like I said, I think it's either going to be miserable or it's going to be fantastically successful.
Yeah.
It's
so the last new major feature for iOS 7 that we saw today is AirDrop. Now, this is something that they extended over from OS 10 Lion and Mountain Lion that allows people to share files between computers over a Wi-Fi network. AirDrop for iOS will work with AirDrop for Mac, and then it'll be built into a lot of apps and just allow people to share things between computers or between phone and computer or between phones. And it uses Wi-Fi, so you have to be on the same Wi-Fi network, but within that network, you can basically share things seamlessly from just about any app. Now, I sort of think this is really funny, because as long as you have AirDrop enabled, if someone else is on your network, you can pester them with as many AirDrop requests as you want. So I'm hoping that they will have a way to easily enable and disable this if that's the case. But in the meantime, I'm going to have a lot of fun needlessly peppering people with AirDrop requests.
It's like a social distributed denial of service attack.
Sort of. I mean, I don't think it's going to be powerful enough to actually DDoS people, but it is going to be inconvenient if someone wants to make it inconvenient for someone else.
No, that's what I mean. It's social. It's distracting. So
you could do the same thing with text messages or emails or instant messages.
It consumes the human's ability to take in more information.
Right, but you have to do it one-to-one. Have to use all of your... You know, you have to consume all your ability to be able to bother someone else to that same amount.
Right, right.
Another feature that they enabled that's kind of a meta feature is activation lock. What did you think about this, Chris? The idea is that if your phone is stolen, it's a security feature for that. If someone steals your phone and gains access to it and tries to either lock it or access your personal information or completely wipe the phone, even once the phone is wiped, it will require your pre-existing Apple ID and password in order to activate it anew.
Yeah, this is pretty neat. This is the kind of thing that you don't really think about. You know, the fact that you can take an arbitrary phone like mine and just reset it and then use it without any consequence, unless I report the unique identifier stolen to the carrier, that's how you think it would work, right? So it's kind of interesting that they're short-circuiting that. So once you activate the device, I assume, then it knows that you are you, and it knows the unique identifier of the phone. And if it gets reset, then you go straight to the activation screen, and you cannot actually use the phone. I think that's fantastic. I do hope – it's funny because with features like this, you do somehow hope that you can switch Apple IDs, right? And I assume they're going to provide a way to switch Apple IDs. But if you if you do actually need to do that, and it's actually you being legitimate and not a crook, there has to be some kind of workaround, and that's where this kind of feature will fall down or not from a security perspective. If it's very easy to switch the Apple ID that it's associated with, then the thieves can just switch the Apple ID, no big deal. And if it's very hard, then people get frustrated when they actually legitimately want to do it. But from what I've seen, this seems like a decent balance.
Right. So my understanding is that the activation lock feature is largely controlled through Find My iPhone, which is an app that you have to use from another device in order to access your phone remotely. So from the device, I think if you have access, you know, if you know your own Apple ID and password, it should still be fairly easy to switch to a different Apple ID. But if you don't have that ID, then you can only control or change the phone remotely. Right. So I don't think it should affect people's ability to change Apple IDs as long as, you know, both Apple ID owners are consenting.
Right, and that kind of makes sense, and that's how it should work. So hopefully there's no, you know, the devil's in the details, like we saw with the Matt Honan breach a while back. If somebody takes control of your Apple ID, then you may have problems.
Right. So this is a bit of a protection against physical defense or against physical theft.
Right.
It does not do all that much to protect you from identity theft online. And furthermore, it doesn't do anything to protect you if someone is able to both physically access your device and get access to your password.
But the key is just to make it more difficult.
Exactly.
More friction.
Right. It's a line of defense against physical theft, which Apple has correctly identified as a pretty serious problem for iPhone owners.
Yeah, so that's definitely a win. It's another layer. It's not meant to end the security conversation, because that conversation will never end. But it's at least one more tool in the toolbox.
Of course. All right. Now, another thing that we have for iOS and for OS X is an iTunes Radio subscription service. And that's what they're calling it, iTunes Radio. So you're able
to
stream. Yeah, you're able to stream music, much like the new Google Music streaming service, or Pandora, or Spotify, or anything like that. And this this service comes free with iTunes Match, which is their library uploading service. I already pay for that. It's pretty cheap. It's $25 a year. Just for the service that it was providing previously, that was starting to feel pretty expensive compared to Google Music Match, which is free, or Amazon. Or a number of other options. But now, having all of my music in the cloud plus access to music that I don't own for $25 a year, you know, that's starting to look like a pretty good deal again.
I do love the it's free with a $25 a year service bit that they tried to pull here.
Well, it's I don't know all of the details. It hasn't been released yet.
Right.
I do know that it's free with the $25 service that I'm already paying for. So I'm excited about it. I don't know if there's another way to get it.
Yeah, it cracks me up because it's Amazon and I guess now Apple are playing this game of, well, it's free with the service that you already pay for.
Yeah.
So that's always been kind of funny because Amazon does the same thing with Prime, right? You sign up for Prime to get the two-day shipping, and then you get videos for free for pay. So that's a little bit weird, but you're right. I think most people that already have iTunes Match will certainly welcome another feature for no more money. That's for sure.
Right. I mean, iTunes Match was beginning to look like a hyper premium service when you could get many of the same features for free. But as compared to internet radio services, which are mostly between $5 and $10 a month. All access for Google Play is $10 a month. Spotify starts at $5. I think Pandora is like $8. I don't remember. But this is $25 a year for both having my music in the cloud and getting iTunes Radio.
And then, so this is a little bit cheaper than the competition, I suppose.
Yeah, it seems to be. I can't wait to see how it's implemented. I don't know how they would manage to do both of those features for $25 a year. It's not usually their strong suit.
So you're right. So the Google Music service is $10 a month, and this rounds out to about $2. So that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah. So pretty much everyone expected Apple to do that at some point.
Yeah.
You know, they've been trying to make deals with all of the record companies for years now, and apparently they've hammered those out. And they didn't make a big deal about having hammered those out, which was nice.
I think it was kind of interesting to see them roll this out now, because I think they had everything in place, you know, from the technical perspective of things. They were just waiting for these business deals to get done. And it just so happened to be sometime before this WWDC that actually happened. So it's good to see.
Right. Now, one thing that is free, albeit with your purchase of any Apple device, is iCloud. And they're adding a bunch of new features. One of them is iWork for iCloud. So you can, this is basically a competition with Google Drive. You can get access to Keynote numbers and pages directly from the iCloud website. And they're pretty powerful. I didn't see any social or collaborative aspects to this iCloud, which is still going to be in beta for the foreseeable future. But I did see a lot of powerful document editing and design features. Right, and so I gotta think they made a big deal about the fact that you are now able to use iWork apps on Windows PCs.
I got to think because of the web browser, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a web app.
And you can use Office on you can use Office web apps on Macs and Linux.
That's right.
Yeah. It's a crazy world we live in. I think this goes up against Microsoft's Office more so than it does Google Docs. Google Docs has always been about this really minimal, stripped-down editing interface that's highly collaborative with few features. And I feel like this has more features and is not as collaborative.
Yeah, in the keynote demonstration, I didn't really see any collaborative features demonstrated. I hope that they add them at some point in the future. In the meanwhile, I'm probably going to continue using Google Docs for the most part. But they did stress that this is a beta. It's going to be developer-only beta for the next few months. And then with the release of iOS 10.9 Mavericks, it will be open to public beta.
Cool. Well, we'll be looking forward to it. I'm sure we'll talk about it more when it actually comes out. As with a lot of this stuff, I'm sure we'll talk about it more when we get closer to the holiday season and and the technology sphere heats up that time.
But another big feature that they're adding to iCloud, and I think this is going to be implemented sooner and is not beta, is password management. So they're calling it the iCloud Keychain. And so they are integrating it, you know, across their whole platform of products. And this is great. I mean, obviously, if you use something like LastPass or 1Password, they are pretty well integrated. But this, if you are the kind of person who uses Safari for Mac and Safari for iPhone, this is going to be completely integrated, and it will automatically suggest full 64-bit encrypted passwords and store them for you.
Or it must be 64 character.
I forget what they said on stage, but it was a pretty long password.
Yeah, it's probably something north of like 20 characters or something like that. That seems to be the standard long password that people use. Yeah, so that's kind of neat. I'm not sure. I know that LastPass will treat all of my passwords with the utmost security and disclose incidents that happen. I'm not sure that I can trust Apple that much.
That is a good point. I mean, with when you subscribe to a password monitoring service, your password security becomes only as secure as the service that's holding the passwords for you. But they have already come out that they are securing everything on their servers with 256-bit AES.
Yeah. So, but I I have to wonder. I you know, I haven't looked at this in any amount of security detail, of course, because, you know, this is news from earlier today. So I do have to wonder if their model is correct or not. You'd have to imagine it is, though, right?
Yeah.
Apple's a big enough company that you probably don't have to worry about it. But I trust LastPass in a way that I trust few other companies, and I know that they will do it correctly, basically.
Right. The other problem is Apple is such a bigger company than LastPass that they will be a much bigger target for hackers to try to access those passcodes.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Especially with Apple encouraging people to use their passwords and to store credit card information on their servers, which I bet much fewer people are doing on LastPass.
Yeah, well, LastPass does have the facility to store other information like that.
I'm sure it absolutely does. I'm just saying that probably a smaller percentage of LastPass's users will store all their credit card information than iCloud password users.
Yeah, I could see that. That seems reasonable. All right. Do we have anything left on the Apple side?
That is pretty much all that I wanted to talk about. Wow. I may get into some more tidbits next week, and there are also some Apple afterburners, but I'll wait to get to those.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll have a little more information as things kind of mature and, you know, as journalists get time to ask questions and stuff like that. So I'm sure we'll have a little bit more to talk about next week is my guess.
Sure, but in the meantime, we can talk about the other keynote, and that was Microsoft's E3 announcement, where they told us a little bit more about the Xbox One. Can you tell us about that, Chris?
Sure, yeah, it's quite interesting. I think it's a little bit less relevant to our podcast. You know, I'm sure there are many gaming podcasts out there that will cover the hell out of this, but it's they're taking the wraps off of the gaming part of the Xbox announcement. So previously we saw the entertainment and TV part of the picture and a little bit of gaming, and we got to see the actual box, but we didn't get a price and we didn't get to see a whole lot about the actual gaming picture. So that is what they are bringing to pass here at E3, and it's interesting to see. So, you know, neither of us are huge gamers, so any kind of in-depth analysis about games from us wouldn't be worth a whole lot. I can at least run down the games, and I'll tell you about one of them that looks particularly exciting to me. How about that?
Sure, sounds good.
So we've got Metal Gear Solid, the Phantom Pain is coming up, and I know a lot of people are big fans of that series, which has traditionally been a PlayStation kind of series. So that's a little bit interesting to see that come over to the Xbox. So we've got Forza 5, which I know Josh Pollard will be very excited about, and I'm sure he will be eager to play that. We've got, it must be the year of the fives, because we've also got Halo 5, and they're going to have Dead Rising 3 and Battlefield 4. Now, two games that really struck out to me, and the previous ones, they stuck out to me in a way that, you know, they're old, mature franchises, and that's always very exciting. But there were two that seemed kind of new and fresh to me, and that one, the first one is Titanfall, and that's this kind of mashup between a first-person shooter and a sci-fi and battling inside of big mech suits. So that seemed like a pretty cool... It seemed like a pretty cool addition to the usual lineup here. And the one that really kind of got a rise out of me, that was a bad joke. I shouldn't have said that.
You want to just start over?
No, I'm fine with that.
The one that really something else?
No, the one that I really liked is Rise. And this is one that we got a preview of in 2011, and it looks like they've been working on it a little bit since then. So it's called Rise, the Son of Rome, and basically you are a Roman warrior, and you are in the first person in this game. And you are like a general, and you get to lead the battle, and you get into battles with people. And, you know, at some point you're part of the phalanx, and you can take out your sword and, like, chop people's limbs off. It looks super violent and super gory, but it looks like a whole lot of fun. So it's using the Kinect, which is part of the coolness of it.
That's crazy. So you're just running around a Roman battlefield as a general in your living room.
Yeah, it's pretty wild looking. So they've got this kind of typical invasion scenario in the preview video that they showed at E3, where you're boarding, or you're landing and attacking some kind of structure, and you have to get into a phalanx to thwart archers and stuff like that, and you get to do battle. So I thought that looked really cool.
Yeah, that does sound pretty wild.
Yeah, kind of epic, right?
Right. So are these all launch titles?
Yeah, all the ones I mentioned and a couple more that I didn't mention are indeed launch titles. So those are kind of the big names and the two of the smaller names that look the most interesting to me.
Right. So we'll see those in November along with the Xbox One, which is going to come out for $499.
$499?
I'm not buying one at that price.
I thought this price is low. I'm not kidding. $499, I mean, when the Xbox 360 came out, it was more expensive than this, wasn't it? Am I misled?
No, you are misled. The Xbox 360 was definitely cheaper. The PlayStation 3, when it came out, I believe it started at $600.
Yeah, you're right. I think that's what I'm thinking of. It was the PlayStation 3 that came out at a ridiculous price. So I thought it was going to be a little bit more than this, so I'm kind of relieved. I didn't think it was going to be less than this, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, you're right. It is a reasonable price. I probably wouldn't have bought it anyway, but I'm definitely not buying it for that price just because I don't need it.
Well, and also, especially for someone like you who's not the biggest gamer, you're...
Or a gamer at all.
Or a gamer at all. You're not going to buy
Angry Birds
this.
Is the majority of my gaming experience.
That is a sad, sad gaming experience.
But no, it's angry, Chris. It's angry.
You're not going to buy this out of the gate at $499. You're going to buy it halfway through its life cycle at, half that or a little less than half that or something like that. So
if it's anything like the last one, buying it halfway through the life cycle, you'll still get a good 4 years out of it.
Yeah, you'll get a pretty good deal about it. So that may be the strategy that some people take.
Okay, well, that was all the keynotes that we had to report on today. So should we move on to our afterburners?
Yeah, we should. I'm tired. This is going to be a long podcast, but it feels good.
Okay. So before their keynote and before the Worldwide Developer Conference, Apple has quietly started offering in-store iPhone display replacements for the iPhone 5 for $149. Now, I'll tell you, I do iPhone screen replacements myself, and for the iPhone 5, I have not yet been able to find a cheaper price than that.
So Samsung is announcing a new Android phone that runs Android 4.2, has a 4-inch screen, and has a 1 gigahertz dual-core processor. It's going to have LTE. This is kind of a budget phone that they're coming out with that will cost a little bit less than all of its flagship devices. So, but all said, it looks like a pretty competent device. So it's kind of exciting to see a lot of these cheaper devices that are still pretty competent as compared to years past phone come to market.
Right, and Samsung has also announced a new version of the Galaxy S4, the Galaxy S4 Active, which is going to have many of the same specifications as the original. It's got a 5-inch display with 1080p, a 1.9 gigahertz quad-core processor. It's an LCD display as opposed to an OLED, but the main difference is that this one is sealed and watertight up to a half hour, and it'll be available this summer off contract in the U.S. and Sweden, and then eventually the rest of the world. And in other phone news, AT&T has joined Verizon in killing their early upgrade on 2-year contracts. So they used to allow you to upgrade somewhere around the 20-month mark of your 2-year contract, depending on your customer credit, and it would encourage you to just sort of stick with them. They've both canceled those policies. You need the full 2 years for your contract to expire before you can upgrade your phone with them, which hopefully in a few years or so will be great for competition, because every time someone's contract is up, they'll be perfectly free to switch to some other contract.
So the Xbox One does have some always-on features after all. It's not quite as barbaric as we thought it was going to be, but it looks like it will ping the DRM server once every 24 hours. So if you're beyond the 24-hour limit, you will not be able to play the games. So I thought it was going to be a little more permissive than that, and I'm sure they still have time to change that. You know, it's just It is just software after all, so we'll see what happens. But that's the official word as of right now.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit disappointing to me.
Definitely.
But here's something that's less disappointing. If the MacBook Pro 15-inch Retina display was not high enough resolution for you, you can now get a Fujitsu Ultrabook that has a higher resolution. This is a 14-inch display that is 3,200 by 1,800 pixels. 262 pixels per inch, runs Windows 8 with a touchscreen on that display, which is just wild. I'm sure it's not cheap, but it's spec'd pretty well, and it's already available in Japan. They don't really have plans to launch it anywhere else. So if you really want it, I guess you have to go to Japan.
So I picked up this interesting story about a 21-inch Android desktop. It's called the Acer N3-220. It's got a NVIDIA Tegra 3 and a 1080p screen, and it's running Android 4.2.2. So this is a keyboard and mouse Android desktop computer. It's only got 8 gigs of storage, though, for the hard drive. So kind of a wacky but kind of interesting foray into desktop computing here.
All right, well, that is all of the afterburners that we have today, so let's shut them down, and we can get into our the end-user stories. We are already pushing an hour this week, so we only have 2 end-user stories, but we would be remiss if we did not mention the breaking scandal that is known as the NSA PRISM program.
Yeah, so this is kind of an interesting story that's come out, and we're not going to really belabor the point because I think this is not really our portion of the tech industry that we really follow. You know, we're really all about looking at technology and the future of technology and what's coming around the bend and how we can use it and what it looks like. And so this is a more security and privacy oriented thing. So it is quite interesting in its own right, although it's kind of, again, it's kind of out of our scope. So it all started with The Guardian publishing a story about the NSA having direct access to many of the top U.S. tech companies' servers and access to their data as such. So, you know, this does have a lot of privacy implications, and this does have a lot of security implications, and I think it's interesting, but we're going to kind of let it lie to people who are really smart in that particular niche in a way that we are not. So actually, you passed along this article, and it seems like a pretty good take.
Yeah, that's right. So the longtime writer and creator of The Wire and Homicide and Baltimore Crime Reporter, David Simon, has been blogging a lot more recently and being very interested for a long time in government surveillance and security. He has a very interesting take on it. It is a great primer in the history of this kind of thing, and it puts it into excellent context. So you should go to David Simon's blog, and we have a link in our show notes, and you can check that out. And if you're still interested, you can read more in a lot of different places on the internet, and you can email us, and we would be happy to give you more links.
All right, so with that, I think you you have a green tech story for us.
I do, yeah. This is just a quick little fun one here. We've been talking about wind turbines a lot. The U.S. Has been making some strides into municipal wind power, and they are finally launching an offshore floating wind turbine. This is our first one. Europe already has many of them. It is really just a 1/8 scale experimental development model off the coast of Maine. But it does produce enough power that it's tied to the grid and sold back to consumers, and hopefully it will lead the way to larger scale offshore wind farms.
Cool. So this is floating. When I first read this headline, I thought floating in the air, and that's not
well. We have covered those on previous green tech stories, but they have not been implemented in anywhere this kind of scale yet.
Right, so this is something that actually exists today that is implementable and is a floating in the water wind turbine. So that's pretty cool.
Right, that's pretty much all I have.
All right. Well, I'm picking up the app pick of the week, and oddly enough, it came onto my radar because this very popular game on other platforms finally came to Windows Phone 8. As per usual, Windows Phone 8 is the last one to get those kinds of games. And the game that is now...
They're way ahead of BlackBerry and Mebo.
Yeah, that's true. And Mego. The Mego phone. And
right, Mego. And I don't think this is coming to WebOS at all.
Yeah, it'll be... I feel bad for people who are still using WebOS. So definitely no modern games for them. So the game is called Deathworm, and it, like I said, it's finally come out for Windows Phone 8. And previously, I think it launched on iOS and came to Android shortly after that. So Windows Phone now has Deathworm, and that's definitely a good thing. It's a great game. If you haven't played it and you are a Windows Phone user, you should definitely check it out.
So you have played it?
I haven't bought it yet, and I haven't played it on Windows Phone yet, but I have played it on the other platforms.
Ah, okay. Well, I've never played it, but since it's available for iOS as well, I guess I will go check it out.
Yeah, you should check it out, too. It's a great game. So it's one of these games that is like a classic. It's not quite an Angry Birds, but it's pretty high up there. So
cool.
Deathworm,
yeah,
go get it.
It looks fun.
Yeah, doesn't it? It's a pretty great game. So I'm looking forward to spending a little bit more in-depth time with it instead of just playing around with it to actually get through the game, you know? It's a different perspective when you actually get deep into the game.
Right. Looks like you can get deep into the ground inside the game as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So Deathworm, go get it. Unless you have Mebo or Mego or WebOS.
Or BlackBerry.
Or BlackBerry. All right. Well, I think this thing has gone long enough. Let's kill it. What do you think?
I don't want to kill it. Let's, let's just put a bow on it.
Let's deathworm it for this week.
Oh, sounds worse. Worse than killing it.
Okay, we can put a bow on it. That's a good metaphor. Anyway, so let's get out of here for this week. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. You can also have a listen to the DMZ's newest podcast, Home On, which is a home automation show by Richard Gunther. It's now in the iTunes store, and it's also in the Zune Marketplace, so you'll definitely want to go and subscribe in your portal of choice. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can do so. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can ping us on Twitter. Together we are at @theenduser. Join us live as we record the show every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.